Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey. Not in a creepy
way. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
First, I'm going to give a shout out to Methods of Instruction students. Anyway, tonight we're going to talk about The Taking of Pelham 123, 1974, directed by Joseph Sargent, who also directed Jaws, The Revenge, and a bunch of TV, including Star Trek, the original series. Brother Jay?
Yes.
Question on my mind. Did you enjoy this movie?
Well, before... Wait, sorry. I apologize. I'm gonna interrupt right there.
Okay.
Should we at least introduce why we're doing this movie this week?
Oh,
this was not the original plan.
I'm sorry. Yes, actually, this is a solemn occasion. The reason we picked The Taking of Pelham 123, even though it's actually probably in my top 100 favorite movies, is that, unfortunately, the great Jerry Stiller, who is in this movie, passed away this week at age 90-something. It's very sad news, but he's a legend. Part of the Stiller Mira comedy duo, and then
was a legend.
Yes, no, he remains a legend. Legends never die.
All right,
people die.
Okay,
but and then he's known as, of course, George Costanza's father, and also Doug Heffernan's father-in-law. I don't care what people say. King of Queens had some funny moments to it. It seems pretty hip to rag on Kevin James, but you know that show was funny.
Jerry Stiller was the funniest person in every scene he was in.
Always. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie, too, actually.
Well, just looking at him makes me laugh.
Yes. I got a lot to talk about this movie.
He didn't get much to do, but...
No.
Sorry, Jason. Sorry for interrupting. Let me pose the question now. What did you think of Pelham, The Taking of Pelham 123, the 1974 version?
Well, it was fine. I didn't hate it. I found it a little bit, it's very dated, which I think has made it very difficult to watch.
Oh, I think it's part of its charm.
See, it doesn't charm me. That just it's immediate turn off. I just disconnect. Because it's just so, it's like, this is, it's,
oh,
it's
we'll
like,
get
wow,
into it.
Yeah. So anyway, so I kept trying to have to remind myself
that this movie was premiered in theaters 2 years after you were born.
I guess that's.
I think one of the things you're alluding to is that they take so many pot shots at women being like the inferior gender in this movie. So many that I thought they're obviously setting something up for later.
Within the first 5 minutes of this movie,
they are not. They're okay, not so setting anything up.
I'm quoting the movie when I say these things. These are three terms that were used directly from this movie in the first 5 minutes: Chinamen and monkeys, in reference to people.
There's that. Yes.
So. That was really difficult. And then a lot of dames, like, this is why we don't give dames jobs. So I think as a cultural time capsule, this is interesting to watch. As a movie, it was really difficult to watch.
Brother Drew, had you seen it before? You had, right?
I'd never seen this before.
Really? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was okay.
You guys are letting me down. I love this movie.
It had some good parts to it. I'm not really a Walter Matthau guy.
Oh, me either.
Yeah, it's just something about him just bugs me. And it was so dated. It was really hard to get into. I mean, it's kind of fun seeing just the different technologies that they had. And, you know, when you take out things like cell phones, it always increases the dramatic tension in anything. And there was some weird tone things with this movie. Sometimes it was very serious and sometimes it was almost slapsticky.
And it was dramatically overacted to death.
Sometimes.
Well, they really leaned on their character stereotypes.
Yes.
Like the accents. Oh, the best.
I really enjoyed the bad guy. And he was Robert Shaw, right?
Yes. From Jaws.
I enjoyed him quite a bit.
Listeners, we had kind of a weird episode. We all had long weeks. And so we started talking about the movie, but neglected to give you any plot synopsis. So if you are interested at all in what we're talking about, here's a quick idea of how the actual movie breaks down. In New York City, four heavily armed men with code names, Mr. Blue, Mr. Green, Mr. Gray, and Mr. Brown, wearing disguises of eyeglasses, fedora hats, and fake mustaches, board different train stations. The Green Line at 59th Street, the Gray Line at 51st Street, the Brown Line at Grand Central, and finally the Blue Line at 28th Street, on the Pelham 123 subway train run of the 6 Lexington Avenue local service. The men take the train, securing a group of hostages, whom they isolate in one car of the train, then disconnect this car from the rest of the train. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Zachary Garber, Walter Matthau, a cynical and curmudgeonly yet lighthearted New York City Transit Authority police lieutenant, begins his day by leading four visiting Tokyo Metro directors on a tour of New York Subway Command Center. This is interrupted by Blue's radio announcement to the command center that your train has been taken. Blue, Robert Shaw, the British-accented leader of the hijackers, tells Garber they are demanding a ransom of $1 million to be delivered to them within 1 hour, otherwise they would kill one passenger per minute starting when the hour has passed. Garber, the sarcastic Lieutenant Rico Patrone, Jerry Stiller, and other transit workers cooperate while trying to guess how the criminals intend to escape from the subway tunnel and get away. Various clues soon surface for Garber to figure out. First, with his hearing Blue's very distinctive English accent over the radio. It later turns out that Blue is a ruthless British mercenary, and Green, Martin Balsam, is a former transit worker who from time to time sneezes over the radio and is heard by Garber, who responds by saying, Gesundheit. Garber also learns that one of the hostages is an undercover police officer. The mayor finally agrees to pay the ransom at the urging of his deputy mayor. The police dispatch a squad car carrying the ransom money. When the car is wrecked in a collision, Garber daringly bluffs to buy some time, telling the takers that the money already has been delivered to the 28th Street station, and only the walk down the tunnel is delaying it. A reluctant Blue agrees to the delay. A police motorcycle completes the trip from the scene of the collision to the subway station, and two unarmed officers are sent down the track on foot to deliver the money to the hijackers. With the money in hand, the hijackers demand that electrical power be restored to the subway line, and that all signals in the path of the train be turned green from 28th Street to the South Ferry Station, both of these being necessary for the car to move. Having overridden the subway's car's dead man switch, which would otherwise ensure it stopping unless someone remained at the throttle, the hijackers get off the train and set it in motion. As the train starts to move, the undercover officer also jumps off the train and hides between the rails. The car begins to travel faster and faster since no one is controlling its speed. Outside the tunnel, Garber and Inspector Daniels, played by Julius Harris, are convinced that the runaway train is a diversion and that the hijackers must have left the train. The hijackers divide the ransom money, discard their disguises, and start their escape into the tunnel's emergency exit. However, Gray, Hector Elizondo, refuses to leave his gun behind as agreed and is shot dead by Blue. The undercover officer, still hiding in the tracks, manages to kill Brown, Earl Hindman, with one shot. Green escapes onto the street. Garber arrives, after Green has gotten away, and drawing on Blue, orders him to surrender just as Blue is about to shoot the undercover officer. Blue asks Garber if the death penalty is available in the state of New York. Told that it is not, Blue responds, pity. Then promptly electrocutes himself by stepping onto the third rail while a horrified Garber watches. Entering the South Ferry Loop, the runaway car finally encounters a red signal. The car's emergency brakes are tripped and it grinds to a halt. The remaining officers are all safe. Green, the only hijacker to escape, has left as a clue only Garber surmised that one of the hijackers must be an ex-motorman for the New York City Transit Authority, owing to the hijacker's knowledge of the car's operation. With the dead three all identified, Garber realizes that the hijacker, still at large, must be a former transit employee. Garber and Patron, working their way through a list of former motormen discharged for cause, pay a visit to Harold Longman. Longman, known to the audience as Mr. Green, is shown rolling in the packs of ransom money on the bed in his seedy efficiency apartment when Garber and Patron knock on his door. He hides the money quickly, then opens to the officers and bluffs his way through their questioning. The officers find Longman's alibi weak, but start out the door until Longman sneezes and Garber says Gesundheit. Garber then reopens the door, the expression on his face, the film's final frame, telling the audience that he knows that he has just found the final hijacker.
There was a lot of people that I recognized from this movie, not the least of which was Doris Roberts.
Yes.
She was fun to see. And Kenneth McMillan.
Is that the dude from Dune?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and then the other crazy face. Well, Hector Elizondo, when I heard his voice, I knew who he was. So I just from voice alone, I was able to.
Okay. So this is sort of a heist movie, kind of. And you have four bad guys that all are identified by colors. The main bad guy is Mr. Blue, is Robert Shaw from Jaws. Quint in Jaws, okay? Then we have Green is Martin Balsam, who we know from everything, plus actually Psycho. Mr. Gray is Hector Elizondo being the skeeziest guy ever. It's so great, hilarious. And then, do you know who Mr. Brown is?
He's the old guy, right?
No. No, he's actually a young, tall guy. He gets...
Oh, okay.
Yep. He's not really recognizable. Partly because he's Wilson from Home Improvement.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Also, Dick O'Neill.
Yep. Dick O'Neill is the train dispatcher who is, like, so crabby.
Yeah, because he was in The Jerk. He's been in everything.
Oh, well, how about the train conductor is James Broderick, Matthew Broderick's dad.
No, I didn't connect those dots.
And I know we're jumping all ahead. The mayor, okay? The mayor of New York City looked exactly like Ed Koch.
That's what I wrote that down. Mm-hmm.
Did you see the trivia that this was way before Ed Koch became mayor?
That's funny.
It's hilarious.
I guess that would be accurate.
Well, maybe that's because Ed Koch was such a New York stereotype. Oh, and the deputy mayor, Tony Roberts. Oh, my God. He was in everything, too, in those days. Great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This had a great cast.
It did have a great cast. It just suffered from some really, really pulpy writing.
Yeah. Pulpy is actually a great way of describing it. It really is just like a pulp fiction movie. It's really simple.
I mean, I appreciated the story and the plot and the premise. So I got that. It was just the syntax and the acting is what I think really detracted. Because otherwise, it's a pretty contained story and very contained kind of set. So that I appreciated that in as much as, you know, it had a premise. It kept you going along. I mean, I was certainly interested in what the outcome was going to be. Although I was hoping that all the bad guys were going to get shot, I was like, oh, this is going to be like Heat. So
I bet you did not predict a Scrooge McDuck moment at the end.
No.
Yeah. So I loved all the heisty parts. I loved
a briefcase.
Doesn't matter. Don't care. There was a bag. I loved Robert Shaw's just like Michael Mann level professionalism.
Yes.
I love that. Every time Walter Matthau showed up, it just bugged me. It took me out of it. I think he was in a different movie. I didn't enjoy his performance. I didn't enjoy just kind of his stupid smug face the whole movie.
He was, you know, he's the star, right? Or the main character, I guess. But he doesn't even have, I mean, he's the through line, but he doesn't have the juiciest part. Like, you would think, like, his, you know, great negotiator skill would be helpful. No. You'd think that his intuition would be sort of helpful. Yeah, I guess. Still, I thought this was great. I thought it had actual good tension. I love the people in the subway car, the train. Oh, my God. And I just want to list their characters' names.
Wait, hold on. I have one more thought to complete, okay, and then I'll let you go. If you plucked Denzel Washington out of the Tony Scott remake and dropped him into this movie and then just scrapped the rest of the Tony Scott remake, you would have vastly improved both movies.
No, okay. So the people on the subway train.
I haven't seen the 2013 version.
Me either.
John Travolta, really?
Oh, so actually, here, let me just read the people's character names on the train car, and then we could probably just go on to housekeeping. I don't know. I love this movie so much, and yet, I mean, it's not a great movie, but it surely is fun to me.
Well, so, being that it's a heist movie, there's not a whole lot to talk about.
Everybody is so over the top, some only slightly, like Robert Shaw, and some like crazily over the top.
Well, but Shaw wasn't over the top.
Well, his character was a little over the top, but no, he was playing it. I mean, really, Hector Elizondo did a good job.
He did.
Yeah. And Martin Balsam. Yep. I mean, you know, these are all quality actors. But sorry, I can't. I know this is super disjointed, but here are the characters.
We're just trying to interrupt you as much as possible. That's taste fine. Of your own medicine.
Payback, yes. So here are the character names of the people on the train during this hijacking. We have the maid.
Did you know in the remake there actually weren't any people in the train?
No, you're kidding.
Yes, I'm kidding.
Okay, I was going to say, that would be the worst part. They took away the best part of the movie. Okay, so here's the character names of the people on the train.
Sorry, I just made that up to interrupt you.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Sandra Bullock. The train can't slow down.
Of course, yeah. Hey, wasn't Unstoppable Denzel Washington also?
Yes, also Tony Scott.
Yeah. As a Doug Benson joke, turns out, Stoppable.
I like that movie.
Yeah, it's a fine movie. Okay, the character names of the characters on the train. We have the maid, the mother, the homosexual, the secretary, the delivery boy, the salesman, the hooker, the old man, the older son, the Spanish woman, the alcoholic, the pimp, co-ed number one, the younger son, co-ed number two, and the hippie. Hmm. I think co-ed number two and the hippie would be a good, like, lounge act name.
Which one was the homosexual?
Oh, he was the gay one.
Yeah, so that's funny. I didn't actually, And it was funny. The hooker, she was great.
I know who that was.
Huh. Yeah, and the pimp was also great. Although, now, did you guess who the undercover cop was?
No,
of course not, because the undercover cop was, you didn't even know he was on that train until you took the gun out of his ankle holster. I was sure it was the pimp.
I was sure it was the hooker. The entire movie sets you up to think it's a dame. Why do they keep talking about how the cop could be a lady?
Because they were horrified that if it was a lady, it would be an awful job. She would do an awful job.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, there was no reason for that level of chauvinism.
No, they didn't even like that there was a lady who was one of the train controllers.
Dispatchers.
Yeah. Yeah, they did not like that.
So I'm guessing that the homosexual was the black guy on the train.
No, the guy that got punched in the face.
Uh-huh.
No, he was the pimp.
Yeah, of course he was. Yeah.
I mean, if we get my stereotypes correct.
Gary Bowling is listed as the homosexual. And was there more than one black guy on the train?
Well, wasn't George Lee Miles?
I lost track.
How many white pimps do we have in 1974 heist movies? this was a different time. I'm not saying that these are positive things. This is, these are horrible stereotypes.
Yeah, man, this movie's awesome.
I do like this movie. Even, okay, the end of it is the cheesiest ending of all time. Have you guys seen? Yes, it
is. You guys are right. The pimp was George Lee Miles, so I don't know who the other guy was.
Is he still alive?
No, and he doesn't have a picture on IMDb.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate. Maybe he wasn't even on the train, although it seems like he would be. Of all of the characters whose traits were really on their sleeves, or in some cases just spoken aloud, I don't know. This, again, the fact that it's a heist movie, yet like the cops are all yakety sacks. Well, not all the time, but the above ground cops are all yakety sacks. The below ground cops are not having a good day.
The what?
I said the below ground cops, The in the tunnel cops.
That's not what I thought you said.
Anyway.
The homosexual.
Have you seen The French Connection?
Mm-mm.
Not Gene Hackman. In a long time.
I haven't seen it in a very long time, but I remember watching the first half of it and just deciding I don't need to watch the rest of this. This is slow and kind of boring, and I supposed to have some good car chases or something in it, but nope. I mean, I must have watched the end of it, but it's like, yeah, I don't understand the appeal of it. And I think the appeal at the time was that he was like a gritty portrayal of a detective or whatever, right? I'm thinking that they were trying to lean on that a little bit and also throw some humor in, like they were going in that vein, because certainly the score was much like The French Connection and all these heist movies. It's all People's Court theme song.
Also an Ed Koch reference, right?
Was he on the People's Court?
I think he was the judge on a...
Maybe.
A version of the People's Court.
Yes, I believe so, on an iteration.
Mm-hmm. So, sometime after Wapner.
Yeah.
But by 97 to 99, Ed Koch was the judge for the People's Court.
Harvey Levin, right?
Yeah. Again, names.
Jerry Scheindlin.
That's Judge Judy's husband, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Marilyn Milan.
Nepotism!
Yeah, she is the richest person in television now.
Oh, yeah. Well, good for her.
Yeah, I mean, I think she sold the syndication rights for like 90-something million dollars.
Good. Well, good for her.
Yeah.
She's feisty.
She is.
She's spicy.
Don't pee on her leg and tell her it's raining. That's the title of her book.
Yes. She says that a lot in court. Do you know where every single episode of Judge Judy I have ever seen has been?
Where?
At the parents' house.
There you go.
Okay. Sorry. Different question than I thought what yours was being asked, but yes.
Probably they are still all on Dad's DVR.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I've seen a court show outside of the parents' house.
That would be a true statement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly not in the current house I'm living in. No, it's fine. It's always a sense of discovery when you realize that, there's all kinds of court shows out there. Court shows that are like 100% scripted. We've got court shows with multiple judges. We've got divorce court, paternity court, all kinds of court. It's great. We live in court-rich times for syndicated TV.
What was the point of the Japanese tour?
Just a little casual racism.
Yeah, just to show that Walter Matthau's character was a complete asshole.
Well, I think it was a lot of master exposition because he was showing them around all of the pieces of their operation.
You were absolutely right about that. So it was clever in that sense. And it showed him not necessarily being an asshole, although he was, but it more showed him as being caught and be like, ooh, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think at one point he called them dumb assholes. Come this way, dummy. Come this way, dummy. He said dummy. Who even says dummy? He's a grown man.
Well, there was a lot of language back there that wouldn't be acceptable in these days and would be a lot. It would just be weird. I don't know. I loved the atmosphere inside that the train control center. It was just great. I mean, all the heavy New York accents and all the union government worker attitudes, and it's just, you know,
the massive overreaction to everything.
It was either massive overreaction or massive underreaction.
Well, there's that.
Well, it depends on who.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why the train dispatcher, Connell, played by Dick O'Neill, was so great. That it's like everything that happened, he thought was just a personal attack on him. Like, you're doing this to ruin my day.
He was the only person in the entire movie that had reasonable reactions was Robert Shaw.
True.
And he killed himself via electrocution.
Yeah. How about that? The heist movie where the main bad guy kills himself. And the most pathetic bad guy gets to do a Scrooge McDuck roll around in the money at the end. And is not even taken into custody, although obviously that's going to happen. We live in the future.
Trapped in a sneeze.
But ending with the door opening and Walter Matthau giving like finger guns almost. It's like, oh.
He just gave that stupid deputy dog face.
I heard that Scooby-Doo yoinks noise.
Oh, man. All of the yakety-sack stuff I thought all of that stuff that I hated in Last House on the Left, I enjoyed in this. to make a strange parallel.
There were so many strange things in this movie that didn't need to be, though. Like, why did we need to see the guy getting a shot in the ass?
Oh, the mayor?
The mayor. Yeah. Like, we knew he was sick. He was sick. He had a nurse. He was being feisty. Like, we didn't need the shot in the ass. That added nothing to the story.
No, I think it added a little je ne sais quoi, a little zhuzh. Just like the fact that we didn't really need to see him throw a Kleenex on a tree. But, it made me laugh. And Doris Roberts, yeah. Oh, it's great.
Yeah, no LaGuardia.
So funny.
Or guess, no, sorry, you're a regular LaGuardia.
All of the stuff with the money, like when they showed all the money being counted, I thought, oh, somebody lived for that moment to edit all that together. It's like they probably had that, like some editor had that all ready to go. It's like, oh, I've been waiting my whole life to throw this into a movie.
Did either of you guys look up how much that would actually weigh?
No.
Did you?
About 35 pounds.
Really? That's not too bad.
No, not too bad. I mean, they were pretty large bills.
Yeah, see, a 35-pound bag is nothing to sneeze at, but it's not, you know, crippling.
How much does a bag of quarters weigh?
I did not do that research. But I did. It would that amount of money would work out to be about 3 cubic feet.
Oh, good to know.
So again, not too bad. It would fit in that bag. It'd be a heavy bag, though.
Sure.
Also, it would work out to be somewhere between $5.2 and $5.7 million today.
Good to know. See, that's the quality of research that we put into this podcast. I don't care what I told the people in class today. We do some fine, fine research. Brother Jay is looking.
Doing research right now. Yeah. Real time.
A $500 bag of quarters, which is that's when I worked at the theater, that's we would get $1,000 in ones and $500 in quarters. That was our weekend change from Loomis. And we would usually have 2 or 3 $500 bags of quarters accumulated over the course of the weekend. It would weigh 25 pounds.
No. Interesting.
And it's a bag of quarters is, I don't know, it's probably about the size of a toaster.
And is it, these are all rolled quarters, so it's like a brick?
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Because when we got held up and the idiot wanted the money out of the safe, which we had, which was $1,500 in ones and $500 in quarters, he didn't really have a quick getaway.
Oh, but he thought he was so fucking rich as he's taking bags out.
Well, it's in a mall. He walked through the mall with... Yeah, so...
Past the kite store. Come on, people.
Larson's Frozen Yogurt and Walden Books.
Good times. Grizzly Burger. Or The Works.
The Works.
The Works, yeah.
But that was past Roundtable.
That's where my fondest Virginia Davis started, at The Works, just so you know.
What? Because of the cashier?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. No one knows what we're talking
about. Doesn't matter. Keep it moving.
Mom does. Mom's laughing.
It's a Julia Roberts thing too, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Oh, good times. So we have proceeded to not talk about Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, which is actually just fine. I still think people should watch it. I think it's great. Now, Jason, you have other notes.
Well, I was interested. Hit a very old school, obviously, because it was 1974, but the openings were very old school. Black and white, open with really bombastic music. It was almost porno-esque music, like 70s porno music.
Oh, the best.
They made a big point of calling
the best era of porno music. You're right.
Of all the porno music, absolutely.
Walter Matthau's character kept saying New York Transit Authority Police, like over and over in the first part of the movie. So that got a little annoying to me. The thing that made me laugh out loud was when the supervisor was like, you can't run a railroad without swearing.
Yeah.
Let's see. And then, of course, the thing that really kind of just made me chuckle was like $1 million. Like, it's, you know, it's some Austin Powers movie. Mm-hmm. $1 million was their big heist.
Also, I like the fact that there was really no backstory. I mean, just some hinted backstory, but really, we never got into any particular reason why these guys decided to do this heist at this time.
The motivation.
Or how they knew each other. I mean, all of the Quentin Tarantino parts were taken out of this movie. Or maybe Quentin Tarantino put his parts into this movie to make other movies he made.
There was no backstory. There was no foundation of how they planned the heist.
Nope.
Was that a doorbell?
No, that was yelling at my dog.
No, it's not real clear. Like the way, you know, the whole idea of the dead man switch on the subway train.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. It was a nice little like red herring kind of thing, except that did you need to show them, like, were they trying to describe, were they trying to build this thing out of pipes that defeated this dead man thing? Was that to simulate what it would really look like to do that? Because it seems like you could have solved it with a lot less drama, maybe. Maybe that's the point.
It needed some better setup and execution there, for sure.
Yeah.
Also, that also seems like something they could have been doing the entire time.
That was my thing. Is like, there was no reason they needed to wait to do that.
Yeah. Again, you have to put yourself a little bit in 1974. There were a lot of like plane hijackings during that time. So the fact that, you know, when they said we've taken your train, they're like, everybody, their first reaction is, what? You don't take a train? You take a plane like everybody does. Come on, people. You know, pretty funny.
Yeah, they're also really cavalier about paying the ransom.
As far as
most movies, they have some sort of conflict about it. Like, you don't want to give in. This movie, they're just like, all right, pay him the ransom.
Yeah, just go find a bank. We have... Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, he gave them a ridiculously short time limit and didn't budge. In a modern movie, that time limit would have... They would have traded some stuff to buy time on both ends of it. And the movie would have been close to 3 hours. And this movie was relatively short. And just... How much fun did Hector Elizondo have just doing like the licking his lip scene?
Yeah, the most fun of anybody in this movie.
Yes. Except for maybe Wilson, who again was really unrecognizable. And just the little things like, okay, so they were all wearing, you know, long coats and hats. And then when they got off the train, they all reversed their long coats and put on different color hats.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe don't wear a hat. It's like,
peeled off their fake mustaches.
Yes, exactly. Bizarre. And how weird was it to have Jerry Stiller, to get back to the reason for the season, as Lieutenant Rico Patron, who he's like a plainclothes officer in the station, but he's all like wearing his like patrolman's uniform when he's going around with Walter Matthau later.
It wasn't even that, was it? It seemed like his dress uniform.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, yeah. So it's like, come on. And maybe that's how things, I don't know. It just doesn't make any sense.
You got to look all fancy when you're going to go talk to the toll booth operator.
Exactly. You threaten the toll booth operator. Again, he's wearing more of like a dress uniform, and yet he's got that 70s fro. Not exactly probably a police regulation, but again, he's the boss, so what can you do? Anyway, any more notes?
Nope.
Drew, any more thoughts?
I think I've said my piece.
Okay. I still think this movie was a great deal of fun. Just the over-the-top everything. Everything was over the top. The sexism was over the top. The racism was over the top. The New York-ism was over the top. The bumbling police were over the top. It's just... And the ending was either the best or the worst ending of any 70s movie I've ever seen. I can't quite decide.
That was bad. It was real bad.
Oh, but... Okay, if it would have been, this film would have been slightly more comedic and been put out in 1986, that would have been a perfect ending.
I'm pretty sure this is the ending that the movie The Breakfast Club was making fun of.
Maybe. Yeah, God knows. It's wild.
Had it been a little more slapsticky, it would have been like a Police Academy movie.
Yeah.
The flipping cars and the crazy driving and the burn rubber and turn around and just the terrible. Oh, this is terrible.
Oh, you can totally see Michael Winslow being a heck of a train dispatcher.
I mean, so many bad decisions in just those last 12 seconds. Like, if you're going to have him open the door and give that stupid, smarmy look to the camera, you have to have him say Gesundheit.
Exactly, yes.
You have to.
Yeah.
So, Brother Jay, what's your verdict on the 1974 classic, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3?
I'm going to give this a C. Solid C. It's a C movie.
Brother Drew, was it worth it?
Yeah, it was. It was. I recommend watching this movie.
If nothing else, for one Jerry Stiller.
He was good. And Robert Shaw was so good. I enjoyed it. I'm glad I watched this movie. It certainly had problems. The ending was real bad and real dumb. Walter Matthau is super annoying. But yeah, I'm still glad I watched it. Good idea, Eric.
Okay, can I give you one thing I appreciate about this movie?
Please do.
Sure.
There was no love interest.
What are you talking about? Walter Matthau and Jerry Stiller were completely in love.
That's true.
the homosexual.
The whole last part of the movie was like a romantic romp for them.
Throw the 50 cents in the basket.
How many more of these do we have to do? We're going to be doing these all night.
Still love it. Recommend it. Seek it out. Per Drew, don't watch the Tony Scott remake.
No, don't. Skip that one.
But, so yeah, this one's better.
I mean, one thing we haven't really mentioned is a lot of the things that seem like tropes and cliches were probably actually very original back in 1974.
Probably. I mean,
the whole, we've kind of alluded to the fact that Tarantino has paid a lot of homage to this movie in several of his movies. So he obviously is a big fan. I mean, he's taken so many things just from this movie.
In his version, you'd see the hooker's feet. I'm just saying.
Yeah. So it's worth watching just for that. So you can get an idea of where those ideas came from.
I don't understand what the point of the drunk passed out lady was.
It was just hilarious. It was a gag.
It wasn't, though.
Because there's always one of those on the subway, right?
I guess. Was this supposed to be the rainbow subway car that was like full of diversity?
Oh, I love like the hippie chick at the just
with the chanting.
Yes, the stereotypical Jewish man. Great, it's great. Again, it's all of 1974, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean, just the fact that the pimp looks at Robert Shaw and says, "What, you never seen a sunset before?" It's hilarious. Makes me laugh. So, housekeeping.
I got a haircut today. That was pretty exciting.
Sweet. From a professional?
Yes.
Awesome. I get one on Monday.
Nice.
I'm avoiding.
Yeah, you haven't had to shave in order to wear a mask. Okay. All right.
I've got some face masks, some cloth ones that I ordered from a couple places, and then I downloaded the program that was suggested by the Rachel Maddow show, in which they were using during the SARS outbreak, but they brought back for COVID, where you upload a selfie of yourself to this website, and then it stretches out your face and you print it out, and then you can cut it and put it over your mask so it looks like your face still.
That's creepy.
No, it's fantastic. But Jesse was like, "That's creepy. Take it off." And I'm like, "Oh no, I'm taking this to work." He's like, "You're not going to do that. That's creepy." I'm like, "Oh, I'm totally going to do this. This is awesome." So I have a picture somewhere I'll send you.
I wonder if you could just braid your beard hair into some sort of a makeshift mask.
Not a very effective one. Plus, it would be super itchy.
Maybe.
No, but could you airbrush the underside of it to look like your face so you could just flip it up? Yeah.
Or, you know, like the when they made seatbelts mandatory in Italy, there was a big run on shirts that would have the seatbelt line across your chest. And then you'd wear the opposite one if you were the passenger.
Oh my gosh. Really?
Yeah. Hey, give me liberty or give me death. Sometimes literally.
Did you know there's a Snowpiercer TV show?
I just saw an ad for it. Wild.
The pilot was shot something like 3 years ago, and it's been through like two or three showrunners since then.
Oh no.
One of them was the dude that did the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Oh. But I assume he's not the last one.
I'm rewatching that on, I think it's on Prime.
Yeah, no, he was fired or quit. It's unclear.
So we have really no housekeeping? That's great.
Well, we're almost in an hour.
Yeah, that's true. Well, hey, anybody from, again, any method of instruction graduate who tuned into this episode might be disappointed with the overall content.
I also bought some printable fabric that will show up in the next couple weeks so I can make my own face masks.
Excellent.
So, I think I sent a picture, but it's not saying sent, so I don't know what's going on with my phone. Technology being what it is.
No, that's not okay.
What do you mean that's not okay?
No.
Wait.
I think it's awesome. Jesse did not.
No, that's one of those images where you see it and 7 days later you die.
This should just be the art for the episode today.
But my mask is on underneath that. I'm complying with the applicable health rules. So in our building now, this is okay for housekeeping. In the one building I work in now, because it's a health clinic, they are scanning everybody's temperature as they come in, which is, that's a good thing. I'm in the building at 5:30 in the morning, so there is nobody else there to take my temperature. But when they see me, you know, come out of my cave, my office by myself, and I walk. So normally I bypass the elevators. I take the stairs when I walk up the stairs or walk up other floors to the building. But today they finally like, before you go up the stairs, can we get your temperature? I'm like, if you want to. And they came over, and then this is a little distressing. She like has one of those scanning thermometers that she points at my forehead and scans it, and it beeps. And she goes, hmm. She scans it again and beeps. She goes, hmm. And then she scans it again. Hmm. And then she takes the thermometer, looks at it, and scans my forehead like a fourth and fifth time. And she says,
you're reading too low?
97.2.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, go on. And I'm like, all right. She's like, yeah, like 97.2. So, you know, my biggest fear is the opposite of that is like my fat ass just ran from the parking lot into the building and maybe like 100 degrees. So. But all was for naught. I managed to make it through just fine. But there's been some escalation of tensions of clients, and people are a little on edge. And so it's been an interesting couple weeks. This was my first week back because I had last week off. So I shouldn't say it's my first week back, but it's my week. I'm back from to a week of work from a week being off. And of course, a lot of shit went down the week I was gone. So that was interesting to try and put the fires out this week. So it's been a busy week. I'm glad it's the weekend. So looking forward to my new gaming chair and my new cable modem so that the podcast won't just stop recording for me.
Jason, have you seen a clip of the new the graphics on the new Unreal Engine that they're going to roll out with the PS5?
I've seen people talking about it, but I haven't seen the video.
It's nuts.
That's what I hear.
Go ahead, Eric. I do have a housekeeping story that just happened tonight, but you can go first.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say, so I've been at class all week, and it's basically methods of instruction training. So it teaches you to be a better trainer and make better lesson plans, blah, blah, blah. And for me, it was more of a lesson in humility. So the first day I get there relatively early, and I'm walking in with some other people, no big deal. I waved my proximity badge, and I heard, like, it went green, and I heard a click, but I couldn't open the door, but somebody else opened there. It was fine. The second day, similar situation, and I'm like, and I put in my personal door code, still did not work, couldn't open the door. And so the third day, and I get there early, and I had to flag somebody down in the office, somebody I don't know, and I was a little bit irritated. And so immediately I'm thinking, okay, my door code doesn't work. The proximity badge doesn't work. Something, my number must not have, must have been left out of some database, or it got deleted from a file. I mean, this stuff happens occasionally. So I send off an email to my manager, like two layers of supervision higher than, or one layer higher than I should have gone to probably. And then also I copied the clerk who works at the training center, saying, hey, I think my door code doesn't work and my proximity badge doesn't work. Is there something you can do to help me? And then they both forwarded it to a payroll person who can get that sort of thing done. And then immediately they sent me, both the payroll person and the training center clerk sent me a little message saying, hey, was the light green? Like, yeah. Did you hear a click? Like, yeah. Oh, well, you just have to push, then pull. Like, I'm sorry? Like, okay. During the first break, I'm like, I go out and I hit the little thing with my badge. It goes green. I hear a click and I push and then pull and it opened. I'm like, motherfucker, I can't even fucking open a door. So, I was not feeling like the best student that day. Like, you know, I'm already feeling like a spy in the house of love, you know, cause this place is just teeming with rookie police officers, trainees, who are all like spiffy and super young. And then, you know, all these hardcore officers who are, you know, bodybuilders and gun experts and stuff. So I come like sort of schlepping in, just trying to not be seen very much, you know, just kind of don't make waves, leave nothing but footprints and, no memories. Yeah. Hey, everybody, I can't open a door. This did not alleviate my stage fright in preparation for my presentation I had to give, but it turned out okay, so it was fine. But
anyway. Well, hold on, though. Everybody else got the push and then pull memo? Because that does not seem intuitive.
Well, the thing is, everybody had, and I don't know whether it was a new thing at the training center or not, but anybody who's been into the officers are there way more than we are. So I probably haven't been to training there in a couple of years. So it was probably just one of those known things.
I've had a similar kind of similar incident at the building that I'm working at, because I am the first one there in the morning. The doors are locked and they're all electronic. And the employee door that I enter is a sliding glass door. And there's a key badge. We have magnetic badges, and the badge is 90 degrees on a wall that's 90 degrees from these doors. But the badge panel isn't in close proximity to the door. When you take your badge up to the badge swipe, it clicks and changes from red to green. It flashes an LED LED red to green to let you know, hey, you're good to go. But it then unlocks the door and the sliding door opens. Well, I'll get there some mornings and I'll click my badge up and I'll hear it click and the door won't open. And then you hear the door lock again. So I'm like, what the hell? Like, it unlocks and locks, but the door actually doesn't open because it's an automatic door, right? So it took, I've worked there, by the way, for 4 years. It took me until a couple weeks ago when I realized that because it's a automatic door, it has a sensor for when you're standing right in front of it. And so if I'm off to the side leaning with my badge trying to open the door, it doesn't see me. So it won't open the damn door. So here I am, like, reporting my badge doesn't work, complaining to building security, complaining to facilities that something's wrong with the door. And turns out, no, it's me.
And, okay, it just occurred to me, this is a perfect kind of thing that it could be a known thing that they just don't, like, put a little note up because it's one of those things that they can see if the recruits will figure it out. there's lots of little things like that.
It's like
that
one of those college entrance exams kind of things.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, it is not unusual, like in my building, that one day you'll have to use your card because your code won't work, or the other day you can't use your card, so your code has to be working. And then if you've ever stayed at a cheesy ass hotel that has the card keys, and sometimes you have to, like, it takes you like 16 tries to get the room door open. Yeah. Maybe I'm just not door qualified. Maybe I just need to go to remedial door school. But oh my god,
I'm really impressed. You try your key like past, I don't know, four times.
Well, I mean, again, over the course of 3 days,
getting all the way to 16 though. That's
no. You mean at the hotel?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not gonna go ask for help. You've met me. Like, it's like 16, and then I say, "Hey, Kelly, you try it," and she goes, click, it turns green, and she opens the door. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, no, I just love the conversation you're having with yourself. Like, after 12, you're like, the next time it's going to work. God damn it. Well, okay, well, this is the one. Well, it can't fail 14 in a row.
No, you have to do every variable. You have to put it in one way, and you got to put it in the other way, and you got to pull it out slow, you pull it out fast.
Nobody beats Eric 16 times in a row.
Well, you got to give it to him for tenacity. I mean, you know, there's something to be said for sticking with it.
Oh, maybe that's where my daughter gets her stubbornness
insanity.
From.
Insanity.
Yes, it is insanity.
Your daughter is stubborn? No.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, here's another thing I like. When, you know, giving a presentation, it's been a while since I did one. I forgot that, you know, on the day before and the day of the presentation, when I'm driving in my car, I am doing nothing but talking to myself like a crazy person, going over and over and over certain parts of it to see if I can remember how the flow goes and everything. Cause I don't want to memorize it, but I need to know, you know, the parts that fall after the other parts. I should be listening to a podcast, not preparing to talk about a podcast. I'm just saying. Anyway, good class. It was a fine class. Also, I don't know about you guys, but we were reminiscing the other day about a training we had all together like 10 years ago. Where it was a 2-day class, I think, and the first part of it was suicidal people, and the second part of it was compassion fatigue.
Oh, I've taken the compassion fatigue class.
It's meant for people, you know, for continuing education in mm-hmm. the health industries, mm-hmm. but it also will work for our continuing education and the team I was in. And, you know, I applied for the training. This was back when we had training money. So I went to the training. In fact, I got a bunch of other dispatchers to go. And when I go to training, I try to buy into it. You know, I try to, like, give it a go. I'm not going to be one of those people who are going to be grumbling in the back saying, this doesn't apply to me, blah, blah, blah.
You invest yourself.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm there for the experience, right?
Yes.
Well, turns out the training fatigue class, it was a lot of bullshit. One of the things we had to do was send a letter to ourselves, and that he was going to mail back to us at some point. And the other thing was the takeaway from the whole class was you need to relax your pelvic floor. Yes. Yeah.
Did they happen to include a coupon for perhaps the Hawaii chair?
No, but they the hula chair.
Yes.
No, but he did. He talked about how all of us are, we are hardened by the fire of our profession, blah, blah, blah. And we have to remember that, you know, from the great heat and pressure because blah, blah. And he's like talking about obsidian being volcanic glass. And then he walked around the room and handed each of us a arrowhead obsidian, you know, piece of obsidian. Oh, and he personally thanked each of us for the job that we did. One of those things where uncomfortably he comes and says, hands you the arrow, and it says, thank you. And then goes to the next person, thank you. And like by the 16th person, it was at that point that I gave up. I'm like, okay, this is way cheesy. So I got out of the class, you know, had notes and everything. And one of my coworkers, who I respect a great deal, she's like, what tremendous bullshit was that? I'm like, well, what do you mean? She goes, this guy taught us nothing. He actually, one of his anecdotes about suicidal people was he had a suicidal client who transitioned from being suicidal to homicidal. And he considered that a victory.
See, that's the line I drew in the sand, how I knew I was no longer an adolescent and had become an adult, is because I had ceased the suicidal behavior and I was then homicidal.
See, and you think that's progress too. Yeah, we were a little appalled. She was a little appalled at that. Anyway, right, and so I'm like,
this was not the class you were in this week.
No, no, not at all. Yeah, this was many years ago. Yeah, and the look, I can still remember the look on her face when she realized she had burst my bubble. I'm like, oh no, I was ready to shave my head and join the cult. like you saved me from shaving my head. You know, I was about to go to an educational center for a while.
Re-education center.
But I took the joy from it. I was like, there was no joy there. I agree with you totally. In hindsight, it was crap, but you know, I was invested.
I do really like the image of you like pumping yourself up to give your presentation this week, like hitting the bathroom before you go and like, just like throwing your hoodie up and looking in the mirror and being like, you know, like knees weak, arms are heavy. Yeah. I was vomiting on my sweater already. Mom's spaghetti.
Yeah. Yep. Totally. Absolutely. Hey, I don't know how you guys do it, but that's what I was.
I fashion a cape and I put one leg up on a chair and I get in my Rebel Yell stance and I listen to Dio.
Isn't that from Henry Rollins?
Yes.
Yes. That's so funny.
Sorry, Jason. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, having had to say the Pledge of Allegiance over the PA every day for a year of my life in the sixth grade, I have no fear of presenting things in public. So culminating in the fact that I had to give the speech at my graduation at college. So I've gotten over all of that. So anymore, I'm just like, eh. It's one of those things that I just had to be zen with, because it happened and keeps happening, so it kept happening frequently for a while. But I realized this morning as I was in my office typing away quietly for no reason, because there's nobody else in the building at 5:30 in the morning, that my life has really kind of come full circle. Because, you know, my job in Anchorage before I left, I was working, you know, 5 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. So I'm back to those 5:30 a.m. mornings again. It's just strange.
So before I forget, so Drew, I was thinking of you when I was putting together the final presentation and giving it over and over and over and over so I could figure out which parts of it didn't feel right and get my words. And I was thinking, oh, now what did Drew say? That class he took about how you should start every sentence with a gerund. It's like, what is a gerund again? It's like, what? Okay, so you start every sentence with the preposition. I'm trying to, like, what is this technique again? I don't have time to look it up. Never mind.
Pronoun, verb, action.
Okay.
So I want to say that I thank you for putting all the Stefan clips together.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because I had seen half of them, but I seriously I've watched them multiple times now just because it makes me laugh so much. Spicy.
It was quite enjoyable, even having heard about this to watch it all. That was, it's pretty hilarious.
Well, I think it's just funniest to watch him when he breaks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, but it is true. I mean, to me, it really is some comedic gold. I really enjoy that because it's funny, but also it's clear that they're having fun doing it. So the Ben Stiller thing was a little disturbing, though.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
The fact that he started out is just like what a silly character, like Ben Affleck's brother, is to me.
Yeah. Hilarious. Yeah, that was terrible, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, but speaking of breaking, you know, the passing of Jerry Stiller meant a bunch of people were sharing Seinfeld outtakes on Twitter. And it is so funny watching him make everybody in the cast break. And he never once broke.
Yeah.
He was so funny.
I'll have to look that up. Anyway, so Drew, you had a story today.
Yeah. So today, just mere minutes. Well, more like an hour before we recorded. So we're back in town, which means we have a backyard now, like a fence backyard to play in. So the kids are out there. Run around. They got like all their summer toys out, and one of them they have a set of like kids gardening tools. So they're like real legit tools, but they're kid size. So there's like a little shovel and a rake. For some reason, they got them out. Yeah,
it's my first shallow grave kit.
Yeah, actually, they wanted to just like dig a giant hole, and we have this like big wooden playground set in our backyard that has like this kind of underneath the raised platform.
I've been on it.
Yeah, where they can climb up, and there's like this tire. It's not like a tire swing that you think of where the tire's like vertical. This is like a horizontal tire that has chains that it can both rock and spin, so you kind of sit on the tire like a seat. And anyway,
under so that, multiple axes and dimension of injury.
Yeah, no, yeah, they've been injured on that plenty of times. But underneath that, it's just dirt. Like no grass can grow there because it gets no sun and gets no rain.
And it gets kicked by feet.
Trodden. Yeah.
Trodden. No grass. That's excellent.
So for some reason, they got their shovel and rake out, and they wanted to dig a giant hole under there. And we told them not to dig, because you don't dig holes in the yard. That's a known rule, right? You don't dig holes in your backyard. Yeah. and my oldest came back at me with a very, like she's very calm and logical and thought out. Said, well, we think it's okay to dig there because no grass grows there and no grass will ever grow there. There is no harm that can be done by digging there. I was like, yeah, but... And I'm about to go into just like shouting mode. It's like, do what I say! It's like, yes, I can't argue with that, but no.
You hit vapor lock.
Yeah, and my wife intervened, and she's like, just let them dig. That's what they want to do. And she's like, girls, go ahead and dig, but when you're done, you have to fill it up. And if you leave a giant hole there, you will never dig again. And they're like, okay, mama. And they're like so happy. And I'm like, I was like, well, that seemed like reasonable parenting. I don't understand why I'm so frustrated, but whatever. So
they're 2 days around. Later, you're like, 811, you have to call 811 before you dig. It says it's a municipal rule.
Yeah. But no, they dig. They played around. They kind of dug a hole, and they filled it back in. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. It was fine. They're good. But they just kind of threw their tools on the grass and got out more stuff to play with. And they're running around. We had some water balloons that we filled up, and they were running around playing with those. And I saw the rake was on the ground, like in a metal rake, not a plastic rake. So I had like the row of metal teeth, and it was laying on the grass, but they were up, you know, like sitcom style, where you step on it and it's going to yes. flip up and hit you in the face. And I thought to myself, I should make them stop and pick that up because that's dangerous. But I didn't. I don't know why I didn't. I either got distracted or I thought, well, I've already been bested by my children once today when I tried to tell them to do something that I thought was reasonable.
Once bitten.
Yes. So I didn't. And then my wife was out with them, and I came in, and I was getting ready for the podcast and doing some dishes. And my oldest comes in, and she was like, just kind of bebopping in, and she opens the freezer, and I'm like, what you doing? And she grabs like an ice pack, and then she grabs a towel, and she's like, oh, Emma fell on the rake. And then she's just like walking out. I was like, wait, what? What do you mean? Emma fell on the rake. She's like, oh, yeah, I fell on the rake. It's pretty bad. You should come look. It's like, what? Like, she tripped over the rake, or she actually fell onto the rake? She's like, I don't know. And I go out there. And yeah, she actually tripped and fell onto the metal part of the rake and like skid on it.
What part of her body?
So she managed to tear up. So I think the teeth hit kind of the side, like just below her ribs, like that soft part of her side. That's pretty, that's got the most like deep scratches.
And we call that the evisceration zone.
Yeah. But she also skinned up her knee and her hand pretty good. So it was a pretty nasty fall. But yeah, so she fell directly on the metal part of the rake. And she's actually pretty okay. I mean, she was crying a little bit. She said it hurt. It looks like it hurts. But she just bopped down here while I was on the podcast, and she's fine. And I don't understand how kids are so resilient. Like, this is an injury that would have had me in bed for like a week.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And she seems fine. I mean, she's the same one that had her pinky slammed in the door. Like stuck, slammed shut. And we got her checked out, and it was fine. It was like a little swollen and sore, but nothing. I don't understand. How are kids so resilient?
Because their bodies regenerate quickly.
Yeah, no kidding.
So. Thinking back, like, that's the kind of injury where you'd be like, oh, go get a towel. We can't really tell the parents that this happened. So let's see if we can fix this without actually telling anybody. Can we do that? This blood is going down the side of somebody. It's like, yeah, it's going to be too much trouble if mom and dad find out that we tripped over the rake they already told us to not use in the first place.
No, that's the part that made me feel so bad. I didn't tell them. I identified this hazard, and now it's just like, whatever. Then the youngest child almost got mortally injured on it. I'm feeling pretty bad about that.
Sometimes shame is a good teacher.
Yes.
It should never be your first choice, though, as a training method.
It might be the best teacher, actually.
Lord.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you wanna catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe rambling. That's the brother Sanderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother.
Jay welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.